Back to My Garden, Episode 8.
Welcome to Back to My Garden. Discover your passion for gardening. Here's Dave Ledoux.
This episode of Back to My Garden brought to you by Coffee Royalty. Hey, can you really lose 5, 10, even 20 pounds or more just by changing your coffee or tea? Check it out and get the facts at www.coffeeroyalty.com. Oh, hi, it's Dave Ledoux. Thanks for listening to the podcast. I've set up a very special website page just for our listeners. It's www.backtomygarden.com/VIP. Shh, it's just for podcast listeners. Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world when you listen to this. Welcome to another edition of Back to My Garden, and I'm your host, Dave Ledoux. Today, buckle up, take notes, get out the pad. Now, if you're driving, you don't want to take notes when you want to get home, but just a wealth of information today. The gentleman joining us on the podcast is from the United Kingdom. He's the managing director of Hillier Nurseries and Garden Centers. He's an author, lecturer, broadcaster, and extremely keen gardener. He's a gold medal winning Chelsea designer for 22 years, and he has two new projects that are on the cutting edge of the teaching world of gardening. I'd like to welcome to the podcast Mr. Andy McIndoe. Andy, welcome to the call.
Jay, thank you very much, and thanks for such a wonderful introduction. I'm completely humbled.
Well, I want to start with your big project, your blog, but before we do, I want to get to know you a little bit, and so do the listeners. Just take a minute, share with us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I live in Hampshire in the south of England. I'm married to Ra, my wife. We've been married for over 25 years. We have two children who now have both actually sort of left us and are living in London. We have here at Sandhill Farm a two-acre garden, which we started from scratch 14 years ago. And it's a naturalistic garden. It has a big area of wildflower meadow. We do grow a few vegetables. We're sort of reasonably self-sufficient in the summer. And we grow a wide range of trees, shrubs, perennials, and we have a massive amount of plants in pots and containers. And we also add seasonal colour to those with things like flower bulbs and bedding. And certainly people often ask us and say, well, you know, what else do you do apart from garden? And we say, well, we don't really. We garden, because that's sort of what we do for a living and what we do for a hobby as well, which is really rather nice. And being as we both do it, that makes life a lot easier, actually, because you sort of share each other's interest.
My goodness. There's a TV channel over here in North America called Home and Garden. And there's a British show called Escape to the Country.
Yeah.
I think you are living the dream.
Well, in some ways, yes. I mean, it's quite interesting sort of balancing. I mean, we have a two-acre garden, and I do write a bit, and I do some radio work, and I do quite a lot of writing and the blog and my garden school site. It's quite interesting sometimes balancing that with a full-time job as well, because I'm also managing director of Hillier Nurseries and Garden Centres, which are known worldwide as for their reputation in the world of horticulture, and also for our reputation at Chelsea Flower Show. And in fact, we've been around for 150 years. I might add, I've been around for all of that, just 36 of them.
My goodness. Now, a lot of our listeners are driving in their cars and they took a deep breath because they can't even picture what 2 acres represents, but you didn't start there. Can you take us back before you were in the country? What was your early gardening life like?
Me? Well, I've been gardening since I was a kid. And I grew up in the Midlands, sort of in the heart of England, in Warwickshire. And I grew up in a very sort of typical semi-detached house. And gardens were very different then, you know, back in the 1960s. A sort of typical suburban garden was a sort of strip of land with maybe a couple of shrubs, two rose beds, and a bit of a vegetable plot and a couple of apple trees. But I was very lucky in the fact that my mother was quite keen, and she had a small greenhouse which she let me take over when I was probably only about, I don't know, 10 or 11. And I was crazy about growing anything exotic or tropical, and I was passionate about orchids. And I'd hadn't had a lot of experience of actually tropical things, because you didn't really sort of, you know, occasionally you went to a botanic garden or found somewhere with a glass house and you found things like that. But I did manage to sort of collect one or two, and then got to sort of three or four, and then it got to quite a lot. And I joined the Birmingham and Midland Orchid Society, and I started competing, and I was really quite successful as an orchid grower out of my 6-foot by 4-foot greenhouse, heated with paraffin and lined with polythene. And I suppose that really gave me the bug to sort of get into horticulture in a bigger way. And then I went off to university, and I did horticulture at university, which was very little known at that time, and that sadly still is today, really, as a sort of career choice. And during that course, I worked in a parks department in Birmingham, and I worked for an export nursery in West Germany, and I worked for a garden centre in Bristol. And I really rather liked the garden centre world, because I liked dealing with public and advising people on their gardens and what they were going to grow. And I quite liked the sort of buying and selling thing. And that was when I left university. I applied for this job I saw sort of as assistant manager of a garden centre in Winchester, which was Hillier's. And I got it. And that was really the start of my career with Hillier. So that was actually how I got into horticulture. As far as gardens go, I have to admit my first home when I bought on my own was a studio flat. And there I didn't have a garden at all, but I had a lot of plants. I had a lot of house plants. And then when I got my first garden, that was tiny. It was only about, I think it was about 15 feet by 35. And that was very exciting, because that was a new build and I started from scratch, and I had the opportunity really to sort of, I suppose, design the garden and grow what I wanted to grow. And it was absolutely crammed with plants and pots and anything I could possibly get into it. So that was, I did start really from quite a small space to actually eventually a much bigger one.
I've had this conversation with a friend of mine recently, and we believe that you're about half a decade ahead of the North Americans when it comes to gardening trends. And I can't think of anybody better, because you literally are on the cutting edge of popularity and fashion. And what do you see coming down maybe a year down the road? What are the trends like in Europe and especially the UK for gardens? What can we expect over here in a couple of years in North America?
Do you know, that's a really difficult question, Dave, because I think it's people often ask me about sort of trends and where we're going in terms of gardens. And it's a tough one, because there is such a wide, there's such an amazing difference between the sort of basic average garden and the garden that people aspire to through the media, through magazines, through what they see on television and everything else. And I think what we've had a bit of a grow your own revolution here in the UK. Everybody sort of a couple of years ago was into sort of growing their own produce, producing their own vegetables. And what sadly has been a bit lacking is the basic know-how. You know, I think we've rather sort of, you get to the stage sometimes where you glamorize something, but actually forget to tell people how to do it. And I feel that actually the sort of return to basics is the direction that we need to be going in. People need to know the sort of basics of horticulture and how to make things work. And you know, sometimes I think we sort of get a bit inspired by an image of something that we'd love to have, but actually we can't attain it. We couldn't attain it on our side. And so I do think that the trend is going to be very much towards plants that really work hard in your garden, things that are solutions which give you pleasure, which don't require an enormous amount of input. Now, generally, people these days are quite time poor, aren't they? Particularly early in their gardening life, is that, you know, we have jobs that are quite demanding in terms of time, long hours, quite a lot of travel. Spend a lot of time travelling, actually, to and from work and actually sort of getting through the day. So I think, you know, the garden, if people really make the right choices, offers the most amazing opportunity as a sort of a place to relax, to actually unwind. It's a bit of a refuge, but that's only the case if actually you see it in that way. I think sadly people see the garden often as something which involves an awful lot of work. It's a bit of a chore because they're not guided into those right choices. So I feel the trend is going to be very much towards things that actually work in gardens, you know, sort of good, hard-working, basic shrub material, putting plants together, achieving powerful planting combinations, and also doing a little bit of grow your own on a smaller scale, things like sort of vegetables in containers, growing sort of a few essential ingredients like sort of salad leaves and herbs when you can produce them easily. And I think that's, I hope that's the direction that we're going to see, you know, gardens going in.
You triggered a memory in me in that if it wasn't my parents and grandparents being gardeners, I would never have been exposed to it. In my 20s and 30s in the big city, it was just another stressor, another time starved on more work. But it wasn't even an option in school. Other than the wet paper with the kidney bean experiment in grade 6, I can't ever remember taking anything regarding horticulture in school, which is the lead in here why your new website is so brilliant, is the educational component, the distance learning without having to drive to a university. You can take education in horticulture from anywhere in the world now through your website, right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, through that's the whole point of the My Garden School concept, is the fact that you can do a course online, and you can do it when it suits you, when you have the time to do it. You're only committing yourself to a month at a time, so it's 4 weeks. And during that time, you can have access to communicating with your tutor and the other students through a virtual classroom situation at any time that suits anybody, both the tutor and the actual pupil. And where people are using that, they're really, really finding that incredibly beneficial. And interestingly, a lot of the, you know, some of the students we have on the courses know absolutely nothing. They're, you know, maybe just like you were, sort of with a bit of an interest, but living in the city and thinking, gosh, I'd quite like to know more about this. Other people actually on it are really professional gardeners. And I mean, I've had landscape architects, garden designers, garden contractors, who basically just want that, you know, the know-how and the sort of the really basic horticultural information and plant selection. And I think that's the great thing about it, is that it suddenly sort of equalizes the students, because, you know, it's a funny thing, is that there's a mystique, isn't there, about anything you don't know about. And I think that's very true about gardening. I'm always quite amused, you know, sometimes actually, because when I go to the gym in the morning, particularly after a weekend, and people sit around having a coffee and they say, oh, you know, I had a really tough weekend, you know, I had to do gardening, you know, it's really hard work. You think you just paid a personal trainer quite a lot of money to put you through an hour of hell. You're complaining about cutting a hedge. You know, this just doesn't make sense.
Oh, fantastic.
Because they see it in a different light.
For those of you driving in your cars or jogging with your earbuds in, I'm going to put a link in the show notes, but it's my-garden-school.com, my-garden-school.com, and it is brilliant. Think of it as the Harvard of learning to garden. But think about this, Andy. If this was 15 years ago, I would have had to drive down to the library, take out a book, read the book, and hope the answer was there.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think, you know, what I've realized is that, I mean, people still love books. You know, people like paper. They like to have a book. They like to hold something in the hand which they can pick up and refer to. But certainly, if you're looking for information and also you're looking for immediate stuff, you look on the internet. And, I mean, that's certainly what I've tried to do with the blog on the My Garden School site, which I'm known as the chief blogger, which I'm not sure is the title I particularly... I'm not sure if that title sounds rather odd. But basically, I mean, I do most of the blogging on the site, and I also actually invite guests to blog on the site. What we try to achieve through that, really, is a bank of information. And you haven't got to enrol on a course to access that, and of course you can interact with that. And it's what's fascinating with it is it does actually highlight what people are searching for, the information that people are looking for. And for example, I did a blog on evergreen climbers, which to me is something I get asked about, evergreen climbing plants, a lot, because it's something that people look for. They want something to cover a wall, screen, you know, something that looks good all throughout the year. And, I mean, that blog went absolutely crazy, and the amount of comment and question we've had on it's phenomenal. And it's fascinating, actually. It's a real... You never stop learning, and I think that's one of the things that is great about gardening, is the fact that you never stop learning. You find different ways, you learn different things, you learn different plants, and it's a sort of almost infinite knowledge, and I think that's one of the fascinating things about it.
You're one of the most experienced gardeners I've had the privilege of interviewing, and a lot of people may be a little intimidated with your wealth of knowledge. I'd like you to kind of expose, though, a challenge or a failure you've had in gardening, and maybe with some humor to it. Is there anything that frustrates you or that you kill? Like,
you know? Oh, do you know, Jay, there are so many things that frustrate me in the garden. Actually, it's untrue. I mean, I'll tell you, actually, every year there are things which that you can't explain. I mean, for example, I have quite a number of peonies in the garden. And the peonies that I have came from a fellow gardener who was a very, very experienced gardener. She was actually the Honourable Mrs. Kitchener, Ursula Kitchener. And she was Lord Kitchener's granddaughter. And she lived very close to me here, where I live, just outside Romsey. And when she eventually had to sell her house and retire to a smaller property, she phoned me up and she said, Andy, I want you to come round and dig up whichever peonies you want and have them, because I know that whoever's coming in here doesn't know what they are. So I naturally obliged, because actually the offer of peonies from Summer's Garden was incredibly exciting. And they have been amazing here. They bloomed every year. They've been fantastic. This year, for the first time, I did the right thing by the books, which was I mulched them extensively with organic matter. I fed them with a slow-release fertiliser. And I really did actually put a bit of love in, and they've been the worst this year they have ever been. I've had fewer flowers and poorer performance. And I could never explain that. And I'm a bit like that with vegetables. You know, this year I've made a much, much bigger effort with growing veg. And I still cannot get beetroot to grow here. I can't get them to perform. They're just a disaster. And I just don't know what I'm doing wrong. And They just don't like me. They don't like my soil. And I think that's one of the great things, is that there will always be the curveballs in gardening. Believe me. You know, however experienced you are, there are some things which won't work.
Oh, the angry flower story. That's going in the blog for sure. Royalty. Fantastic. Well,
it's,
I guess that's why...
Don't you find that, though, with yourself? I mean, you must do. I mean,
well, see, I'm what you call an enthusiastic amateur. So I'm in my third season, while my wife, who's taking the Master Gardening course in school in season 15, I've gone from unpaid help to something we do together. And so I'm in total learning mode all the time.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's an advantage. I'll tell you another one this year is I never grow tomatoes from seed. I usually buy one or two grafted plants and grow them half-heartedly in the conservatory and get a few tomatoes, and I'm quite happy. This year, I grew tomatoes from seed, and I grew a variety called Rosella, which is supposed to be this gorgeous dark purple, and it's supposed to have flavours of raspberries and red currants, and it's supposed to be totally amazing. Do you know, these things, actually, the first flower they've produced is 4 feet off the ground. I mean, I've ended up moving them out onto the front drive, and they're up 8-foot canes, and I've only got sort of about two trusses on the things, and they're the worst I've ever had. So, you know, it's all an experience.
When you described the flavors, I thought of, like, the wine tasting and...
And that's what I thought when I read the packet, actually. Yeah.
It's all imaginary, you know, and it's all sophisticated. And, growing heirlooms, though, I have to tell you.
Heirlooms are really big with you, aren't they?
My wife picked it up. She's part of the Seeds of Diversity program, where it's a seed-sharing program. And I understand why the pioneers were so skinny, because North Americans, you know, they want every tomato perfectly round, perfectly colored, no blemishes.
Yeah.
And these things are grotesque, and there's two on a vine, but the flavor is extraordinary.
Is it good?
We had the number one tomato from Siberia this morning. It's called a Sasha Altay, and it's big in Siberia because they have such a short season, so it's our first tomato of the season. And until you've had an heirloom tomato, if you've been eating store-bought, it's just not even the same food.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the great pleasures, isn't it? Is actually, I mean, of actually producing your own, of growing your own stuff, is that occasionally you do get something you think, gosh, that was really worth it. You know?
That's been my shift, is the, you know, you need a message. And my message is grow something. I mean, food does not come from a big store that you drive to. Food comes from your own labor.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just, you know, start with lettuce and a tomato and a radish.
But I think that's one aspect, isn't it? Is that I don't disagree at all. I think there is great pleasure in producing something and eating it and actually experiencing a different flavour. But I also do think, I mean, for me, the aesthetic aspect of gardening is incredibly important. You know, I'm very much into ornamentals. I'm into putting plants together, and realistically, I suppose, I mean, in a way, it's sort of painting with plants and sort of experimenting with what things look like together and combinations and so on. And I think that's something sometimes that's underestimated, the impact of it. And it's we have quite a big Cotinus in the front garden, Cotinus grace, which is a variety of smoke bush, which has quite a big leaf. And it's quite, at this time of the year, it's wine red, the foliage, and it goes flame in autumn. And this year, it's just covered in these smoky plumes, which they are at this moment. And when I left the house this morning, and it was a lovely morning very early here, and the thing was covered in dew, so the plumes were just pure smoke. I mean, it was just amazing. So I sort of dashed out and got the camera, you know, and photographed it. And it was interesting, you know, I came in tonight and my wife said, gosh, he said, do you notice the katanas when you went out this morning? It looked just absolutely amazing. And it is that. It is those moments you get in a garden where, you know, something to do with the light and the colour and the foliage and the flowers and the whole thing is just, it sort of makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand on end. And that's really, I think sometimes we underestimate the effect that has on us.
I love it. I love it. I mean, there's obviously something in our eyes that is, you know, why else would we have such giant green lawns for centuries now and golf courses? And
yeah, the green space is very important, actually, isn't it? I mean, it's very powerful.
I just looked at the clock and our half hour is just whipping by. And now is the time in the podcast where we get to play my favorite game. It's called Five Quick Questions. And this is where you get to drop your wisdom and experience and share it with everybody.
Okay.
You ready to play?
Yep. I'm ready.
Question number one. What do you think stops most people from getting into gardening?
I think it is probably thinking they'll fail. Fear of failing.
As an adjunct, when you got into orchids, what was the learning curve like on that?
Fascinating when you lived in a house where I actually got ice on the inside of the windows during the winter. You didn't have central heating and you had to sort of track down the garden and heat your greenhouse with paraffin. I mean, that was a challenge. And also getting them, because, I mean, you couldn't go out, now you can go and buy them in a supermarket. I mean, then you had to send away for wild collected stuff. So it was very different.
It's good that you like a challenge.
Yeah, I liked the challenge. I wasn't going to fail because I had actually seen these pictures in a book. And I wanted it, you know, I just wanted to see it. I wanted to see that happen.
Question number two. What is the best gardening advice you've ever received?
The best gardening advice I've ever received is probably, if you want to grow it, have a go. Because actually, plants haven't read the book. And that actually is so true, because so often you will see things which say, you know, it prefers an acid soil or wants deep, well-drained, fertile soil that never dries out. Nobody has that, you know. And I've discovered over the years that actually most things you can make to happen. You know, there's a few sort of the extreme fussy numbers, like the sort of ericaceous subjects and so on, if you're on chalk. But I do think that's true. I think, you know, plants haven't read the book, so give it, if you want to try it, give it a go.
Nice. Question number three. If you had just two websites to share with a beginning gardener, what would they be?
Well,
let's take the easy one, my-garden-school.com. Obviously, that's where we start.
I'm going to have to recommend that, because actually that's why we started it, really, was with exactly that in mind, was that would be for everybody, and it would be something that if you knew nothing, you could still enjoy. The other one probably would be... I would recommend the Royal Horticultural Society's website, although it has far too much on it at times, and sometimes it's quite confusing. I still think it's a bit like diving into one of those big gardening books where you sort of, you know, you flip from area to area and think, gosh, actually, I didn't know it involved that, and gosh, isn't that amazing, and yes, I'd like to go there, And so for us, I mean, that's really important. And I still think that actually has relevance on a global scale. I think, you know, the Royal Horticultural Society does have a global reach. And I think I would still recommend that you sort of have a look. Because it does give you some idea of almost the diversity of what horticulture is about.
Can you give me the URL for that one, Andy?
It's rhs.org. org.uk, I think.
Okay. I'll look it up and put it in the show notes. Yeah, we'll figure it out. Good, good. Question four. I'm in my third season of gardening. Obviously, vegetables. Now we're getting into shrubs, succulents, a lot more into the flowers. What is a good book that you can recommend that I read this summer?
I can't recommend mine, can I?
Please recommend yours and one other.
Well, I've got a new book just coming out, and it's called The Creative Shrub Garden, and it's published by Timber Press, and it's published on 1st of August. And I hope, actually, that you would find that an inspiration, because I've tried to gear it into, not into the straightforward of right plant aspects of sort of right plant, right place, although it covers all of those aspects. But a big part of the book is all about creating moods and styles with shrubs. And I'm talking about a completely sort of shrub-centric garden, which has appeal throughout the year. And it's really based on the one thing that I found is that everybody chooses a plant on its individual attributes and rarely thinks about how it can associate with two or three other plants to make a planting combination. And I think at your stage, what you'll find really amazing is how much more impact you can get by putting three well-chosen plants together rather than just choosing all of them just for their individual qualities. And that really is what the book's about. It's about creating different styles, different moods, different looks, just by taking three plants. If you only got a tiny garden or a balcony or a courtyard, adding three plants. If you've got a bigger space, adding three more plants if you've got an even bigger space, adding a few enhancements if you want to. And also within it, I do give you all of the basics that you need to know on pruning, watering, cultivation, planting, choosing. So I hope that that is something that, you know, will inspire people, whether or not they're actually a new gardener or an established gardener.
I think
I had to choose, am I allowed one more book?
Sure, absolutely.
Do you know, the one book that got me really inspired, and it's quite an old book, actually, but a book that got me very, very inspired was a book by Penelope Hobhouse called Colour in Your Garden. Penelope Hobhouse managed and lived in one or two of the National Trust properties in the UK. And she was very... That particular book, somebody bought it for me, and I spent months, maybe years, just picking it up and looking at it, thinking, yes, I want that, because it included beautiful photographs of good, basic use of colour and the power of plant material. And I think if you are, you know, if you feel the aesthetics of gardening, I think that's one that I'd definitely recommend.
Brilliant. If you haven't been to Timber Press, you went over a lot of listeners right now when you talked about balcony gardens and patio gardens. There's something for everybody. Your book is called The Creative Shrub Garden.
The Creative Shrub Garden, yeah.
It's going to be out on Timber Press when they listen to this. So, and if you haven't been to Timber Press, it is a virtual cornucopia of resources. And if you're going to take an online course through Andy's University, it'll fit in right there with your library. Let's transition into question number five. Wrap this up. Is, in your opinion, Andy, what's the number one thing every gardener should attempt to grow next year?
I mean, obviously that's toughy, isn't it? Because it depends where you are. If I was going to recommend one perennial, which I am completely taken with at the moment, it's a Diasia. It's Diasia personata. And there's a hybrid which is similar called Diasia hoplis. And the reason I'm completely blown away with it is it's quite a tall diacea. It's a sort of more, it's a herbaceous perennial stature diacea rather than a container plant. And it flowers in my garden from early June, sometimes starting in late May. And last year, I photographed it in late October, and it was still looking fantastic. And certainly, I mean, the clumps of it actually have really grown this year in the garden. I mean, we've got a bed down by within the meadow with some sort of herbaceous in it. And I've had a lot of people through the garden because we take groups during June this year. And I can honestly tell you that everybody has, that has been the one plant that everybody has gone crazy for. It's a wonderful sort of, it's a glowing salmony pink. If you like things like Verbena benariensis, digitalis, if you like your lupins, your foxgloves, it's sort of tall, airy perennials, you will go crazy for that. And it's a really good performer, really good with grasses. It sort of almost fulfills the role of an early flowering nuthofia. So if I had to choose one, and it's an interesting thing. I did a book a few years ago called Losing the Plot, which was all about downsizing and what you could grow in a tiny garden. And I did a section in that called If You Only Have One. And I went through all of the different categories. And I look back on that now and I wish I'd put that diacea in it. But I hadn't discovered it then. That's something I've learned since.
So there you go, folks. That's the showstopper. Diacea personata?
Yeah.
Look at me using Latin on a podcast.
There you go.
Fantastic. Well, the visual appeal. A lot of people in small spaces really want that. Your problem or a rabbit problem, you'll have 15 people right away helping you.
It's fantastic, isn't it? It is absolutely amazing. It's a great community.
Make sure you pick up Andy's book. Please go there now and share his links. It's The Creative Shrub Gardener at Timber Press. And what was the name of the original book? Losing the Plot?
Losing the Plot. That's by AA Publishing.
That's clever. I like that. I want to give you the last word for our listeners, Andy. Do you have a note of encouragement or some words of wisdom that you can leave us with today?
That's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, I think you... I suppose my word of encouragement to anybody is that, you know, if you've got a space where you can start growing something, then just have a go. And it's interesting. I mean, you obviously have heard of James Wong, who is a sort of fellow gardener here, who's much more, he's an ethnobotanist. He'll always correct you and say, I'm not a horticulturist, I'm not a gardener, I'm an ethnobotanist. But he did say, you know, that it's very easy to fall in love with growing, even if you're not in love with gardening. And that is your first stage, is start growing something, get into the fascination of growing something, seeing it perform, seeing it flower, seeing it fruit. That is your first step then to getting in touch with plant material, and that's your first step in getting into touch with gardens, really. And I think sometimes people go at it from the wrong angle. You know, they get somebody in, they get the garden done, they expect it to look like that forever. And, you know, anybody starting with a new garden, my first question is always, right, okay, fine, how much time are you going to spend on it? Because gardens need nurturing. It's a bit like having kids, isn't it? You can't just have them and then that's it. You've got to grow with it, and you have to look after it and make it happen. And the same with gardens.
Fantastic. Andy, you've been absolutely brilliant. It has been my honor and pleasure to interview you here today. Listeners, please go to Andy's blog, follow him on Twitter, and share his information on social media. Check out his new book and tell the world and share his content. Andy, thank you so much for being on the call today.
Thank you very much, David. It's been a really, really great pleasure. Thank you so much.